Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Amy Helfeld from Seattle, Washington, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, introduced beautifully there by Amy Helfeld. Amy in Seattle, Washington, which might be why David is wearing his Seattle Seahawks jumper this morning, or it might just be that the entirety of David's wardrobe is Seattle Seahawks memorabilia. Hello, David.
Hello, yes. I did get asked why I was at a British, inverted commas, soccer game the other day with an NFL Seahawks top on. And yeah, I mean, that's what was clean. And there were about another four options behind that one as well, but not much else. So you are right.
He's got hoodies, he's got bags, he's got neck pillows. He is basically a walking advert for the Seattle Seahawks merchandise shop. Matt Roberts, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Yes, a day ending in Y is a day that David is wearing some sort of Seattle merch. I find it very comforting, actually. If David comes on here wearing something else, it's going to be like, what's going on in David's world? This is how I now think of David in his Seattle.
Yes, it's our new normal, to borrow some COVID lingo that absolutely nobody misses whatsoever. We have lots to get into today, folks. Indian Wells is underway in earnest. We're going to be covering the results and stories that we've seen so far. And there's been a fair bit of major news in the tennis world over the course of the last 7 days, which we're actually going to lead with on this show. But first, I need to tell you about On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. We are proud once again to be sponsored by On Location during the BNP Paribas Open at Indian Wells. Now, On Location currently has fantastic ticket hospitality and travel packages available for the Miami Open, the Madrid Open, Roland Garros, Wimbledon, the US Open and Laver Cup. So basically any tennis tournament that's worth its salt. And we have a 10% discount code currently for tennis podcast listeners to 2024 Roland Garros official VIP ticket packages, courtesy of Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tour. So if you want to go to Roland Garros and do it in style, and if you're going to Roland Garros, why wouldn't you do it in style? It would be thoroughly un-Parisian to do it any other way. Then On Location are the people to go to, quite frankly. The packages include official Category 1 2024 Roland Garros ticket on court Philippe Chatrier. And folks, it's the return of me mentioning in a sexy voice access to La Mezzanine at L'Orangerie, which of course is the, it's one of the many incredibly chic locations on site at Roland Garros. But it's also the venue for the Roland Garros draw, which in order to be able to attend this year, we have booked disgustingly early flights. And I'm already anxious about what time that will involve getting up. But I'm sure it'll be worth it once we find ourselves nestled in La Mezzanine at L'Orangerie and Matt's got his draw face on and some sort of sportsman from a different sport that I don't recognise is walking out onto stage and French people are saying, ooh la la, when, you know, Artifice is drawn to face coming out of retirement Gilles Simon or something. I can't wait, folks. Yeah, and you can get to go there as well, courtesy of On Location. There's all sorts of hospitality offerings inside La Mezzanine, cocktails, hors d'oeuvres. That would improve the draw, wouldn't it? I do like the French Open draw, but there's a distinct lack of cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. Not so for guests of On Location. You can also have the option to elevate your dining experience with a premium sit-down meal at L'Orangerie, which has been completely renovated and reconfigured in the Auteuil greenhouses. Enter this 19th century half-timbered building surrounded by greenery and enjoy a gourmet lunch away from the hustle and bustle of the tournament at a shared table exclusive to guests of Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours. You can also upgrade to premium access at Club des Loges Lounge, which enables you to get even closer to the action. So all of that and a 10% discount code for listeners of the Tennis Podcast. What you need to do is go to toursfortennis.com/podcast. That's toursfortennis.com/podcast and use the discount code CLAYSEASON at checkout. That's CLAYSEASON. And we also have a 5% discount code, which is applicable to all On Location tennis events besides the Olympics. So that is Miami, Madrid, Wimbledon, US Open and the Laver Cup in Berlin. And that discount code is exclusively for friends of the pod. So become a friend to get access to that code and lots more as well. Terms and conditions do apply. Now, news. There is, of course, one bombshell news story from the week that's just been in the tennis world, which we have to lead with, and that is Simona Halep. She has had her four-year anti-doping ban reduced to 9 months on appeal by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. She can start playing again immediately with the time served on that ban. And we have now had confirmation that she will return next week in Miami with a wild card. Now, before we get into chatting about this, I feel like we should get our ducks in a row in terms of the facts. So here's a reminder of the timeline. She tested positive for roxadustat, an anti-anemia drug which stimulates the production of red blood cells in the body, at the US Open in August 2022. Her defense was that it was from contaminated collagen given to her by her new coaching team led by Patrick Mouratoglou. He had admitted this happened and took blame for it. She said recently that she hasn't spoken to him since and insisted that her taking of a banned substance was unintentional. The International Tennis Integrity Association has also said in a 126-page report upon delivering their four-year ban, which, by the way, they had initially requested to be 6 years, they'd said in that report that the roxadustat in her system had, in their estimation, also come from a second unidentified source. And they also charged her with irregularities in her athlete biological passport. Throughout, Halep vociferously denied intentionally taking anything and appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. That case was heard a little while ago and the verdict was delivered last Tuesday. The BBC reporting CAS as having said, having carefully considered all the evidence put before it, the panel determined that Ms. Halep had established on the balance of probabilities that the roxadustat entered her body through the consumption of a contaminated supplement, which she had used in the days shortly before the 29th of August 2022. The roxadustat, as detected in her sample, came from that contaminated product. As a result, the CAS panel determined that Ms. Halep had also established on the balance of probabilities that her anti-doping rule violations were not intentional. Although the CAS panel found that Ms. Halep did bear some level of fault or negligence for her violations, as she did not exercise sufficient care when using the keto MCT supplement, it concluded that she bore no significant fault or negligence. Halep was charged in May 2023 with a second separate offence when the ITIA said irregularities were found in her athlete biological passport. The ABP programme collects and compares biological data to spot discrepancies in an athlete's blood over time that suggest possible doping. Three experts, Dr. Jakob Morkerberg, Dr. Laura Garvican-Lewis and Professor Giuseppe Donofrio, assessed 51 valid samples of Halep's blood and each concluded there was likely doping. Halep's defence suggested the irregularities spotted were caused by factors including blood loss during an operation and periods when she was not training. CAS said it was not comfortably satisfied Halep had committed an offence and the panel therefore dismissed that charge. We've yet to see the full reasons that CAS came to this verdict and we'll bring them to you and react to them when we do. The ITIA's Chief Executive Officer Karen Morehouse said, an essential element of the anti-doping process is a player's ability to appeal and the ITIA respects both their right to do so and the outcome. The ITIA awaits the full reasoned decision and will review it thoroughly in due course. So Halep's nine-month ban was backdated to October 2022 and she's been given a wild card to Miami. She said, in the midst of this challenging journey, my unwavering belief in the integrity of the truth and in principles of justice has been my beacon. Looking forward, I am eager to turn this page and rejoin the tour with renewed vigour and an invigorated spirit. It was quite a bombshell when this news dropped last Tuesday. We did debate doing an emergency podcast, didn't we? I was waiting for the text from David saying, emergency pod, question mark. Look, it was borderline, quite frankly. But here we are, decided not to do that kind of 6 days later, having had time to process it and see various different reactions and get the news that she will be playing in Miami and that will be where we'll see Halep's comeback. David, you first. What's your reaction?
Bemusement, befuddlement, frustration. At a system that can measure somebody's liability and punishment for having something in their system at 4 years when they actually want it to be 6 years, and then the same evidence be looked at by another organisation and it to be 9 months. How can we be in a situation after all this time that you have two bodies seeing the same evidence and viewing them so dramatically differently? It really has knocked my trust in that system and belief that we're ever going to get to a place which is going to catch people that are cheating, that is going to work out a sensible punishment for people who have something in their system, even if they didn't intend it to be there, but they are playing enhanced effectively because they have it in their system, and that I can trust that verdict. Because, you know, I actually listened back to all the podcasts we produced at the time of her initial testing positive, her subsequent additional charge of irregularities in her athlete by biological passport, and then the one when they delivered their 126-page verdict and the 4-year ban. And I feel a bit naive that I trusted that process to be something that couldn't be torn down and reduced to this extent. Now, the truth is it may be that the ITIA were closer to what it should be than CAS is closer to what it should be. But the fact is that they're that far apart, I just don't know what to think. Now that I don't have all the reasoning yet, and I look forward to reading it, but, you know, there's been a lot of cases where it has been reduced on appeal, but nothing to this degree, nothing as dramatic as this. And I just, I don't, I don't know where we go next. I don't know how we get to a point where we get a system that properly looks into and tries to catch people who are cheating without getting people as collateral damage. And I don't necessarily mean Halapir, but there are other people that will have had stuff contaminated, and it be taking such a long time to review them. And I at the same time think, well, you need that time in order to get a clean sport. And yet you've got Halapir, who's been given a 9-month ban, of which it's taken 18 months to arrive at that verdict. And so effectively she's been kind of penalised an extra 9 months. What am I supposed to think off the back of that? I'm not that clued in to anti-doping generally. I feel like lots of people in our world know a lot more about it than I do. I just kind of trusted the process a bit more than I now feel I should have done. And it really, I feel pretty bereft, to be honest, Catherine. I don't know where we go from here.
Yeah, it leaves you feeling naive and foolish, doesn't it, for trusting the authorities and trusting the process so unquestioningly, I suppose. But that's obviously where we all want to be. We want to be able to trust in those authorities, or else what is the point of them if they have no authority? Matt, where is your level of trust and confidence right now that dopers are being caught, and that those people that are being caught are not, in David's words, collateral damage, and are justly being caught and identified?
Yeah, very similar to David, really. It's hard to believe that you can trust the system. As David said, we've had so many cases now that have either gone to the Court of Arbitration for Sport or been reviewed by an independent tribunal, and the original suspension has been dramatically reduced or overturned. This is a very common theme. This is perhaps the most extreme example, but this has happened a lot. Reading Matt Futterman's analysis and speaking to him a little bit, his take, and he is someone who has covered many more doping cases and is one of those people who's clued in and much more in the know than I am. His take is that the International Tennis Integrity Agency is such a new organization compared to CAS and compared to WADA and all these other doping authorities. And there is perhaps a little sense that they want to catch someone, they want to make a statement, and perhaps Halep was that person. And Matt Futterman all along said there was absolutely no way that the evidence suggested that Halep deserved a 4-year doping ban and that it was always going to be reduced. I think apparently a lot of the players behind the scenes have been pretty supportive of Halep, given that they all do take supplements, you know, and I think they're all sort of wary of the fact that they could be in a similar position of sort of unknowingly taking a supplement with something in. And there's large concerns about how long this process has taken, as David said, sort of 18-month wait, even though it's ended up being just a 9-month ban. Other sports and leagues have got agreements in place in terms of how long cases can take, and tennis doesn't currently have that. And I believe that's something that the PTPA are very much looking to try and get involved in, because you can't get time back, can you? So there is this sense that maybe the ITIA slightly overreached, but at the same time, as David said, I read that ITIA report, and you know, to me as a sort of novice in this, it all seemed quite compelling and quite convincing. Therefore, to come to such a drastically different conclusion, it does feel like the system is pretty broken here, and something pretty serious needs to change with how these doping offences are dealt with in tennis.
Yeah, I feel like going to the Court of Arbitration for Sport to get the time back that I spent reading that 126-page report times three for all three of us, right? Because we took that really seriously, and it was presented as it reminded me of the time I went to the Premier League's crash course. I was doing some football presenting at the time, and I went to the Premier League's crash course in VAR in the season that was introduced, and they were explaining the Referees Association was explaining their process of video assisted reviews of offsides, and they just presented it as black and white. They said, we've nailed this down to science now. Like, it's just incredibly simple. It's science. Here's how we do it. Here's how we do it. Boom, done. And I thought, oh, that's great. Like, who doesn't love a black and white situation? That's what we're all seeking in these sorts of scenarios. And that's how I felt reading that 126 page report. I mean, because of the athlete biological passport, the reason that exists is to give extremely detailed athlete-specific baseline data, which is unarguable, and to provide concrete evidence. And it was presented as extremely... They just said, it is simply not possible for this level of this substance found in the blood samples to have been produced just by a contaminated sample. And that is that's scientific and not up for debate. And I thought, okay, black and white, fine. And it now seems to be very much up for debate, doesn't it? I mean, Hallett presented the defence that the irregularities were caused by blood loss during an operation and periods when she was not training. So what's the point in that, in the athlete biological passport, if it's not to clarify things, if it's muddying the waters further? What are we doing? What are we doing? It's also a bit of a revelation to me that the blood testing isn't routine in tennis. The blood samples are only called upon, the athlete biological passport only called upon in the instance that something you present a positive test via urine sample, I think. So the whole system is just kind of revealed to be so much less comprehensive and foolproof and generally scientific than I really realise. And I'm sure that's not due to lack of effort, but it's a real moment of, you know, seeing grid lines being drawn up to armpits on a football pitch and realising the whole thing is just a complete mess. And bereft is a brilliant word, David. I feel completely bereft.
It's not very helpful, is it, to a poor listener who's listening to this and saying, well, how are we supposed to know what's going on? Or maybe they feel like, well, you should have known that all along and I shouldn't have been that naive. But, and I do feel a bit like that. But I'm serious. I don't know what the real solutions are. And I was reading back on Tara Moore's case before we came on air and how her case presented contaminated meat as the reason for having two substances in her system, and an independent tribunal ruled that absolutely that was the cause of it, and the ITIA said that they were reissuing continually information to players about the dangers of contaminated meat in certain parts of the world, and now the ITIA have appealed that independent tribunal and their assessment. So Tara Moore's weight carries on. Now, maybe she's still at fault, but it's just interminable. And I still don't necessarily trust the results. So how do we get a system? I just don't know.
Yeah, in any situation where the authorities are perceived and in reality not fit for purpose makes doping more likely. If detection and prosecution, that's not the word, you know, non-legal prosecution is feeble, then of course that makes doping more likely. This is going to lead to more doping. I don't know how much doping's happening right now. I really, because we've got apparently no way of knowing. But I definitely think there's now going to be more of it in the future because there's no substantial deterrent, is there?
Can we get Cass and the ITIA in the same room, please, for a few weeks just to sort of like not leave until they work out what is and isn't allowed and what punishment should look like? Okay, now I know I'm naive and I know that's unrealistic, but seriously, I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, Simona Halep will be coming back in Miami, and my goodness me, that's going to be a much spotlighted event, isn't it? Are we looking forward to that? How do we feel about that?
I am looking forward to it, I think, ultimately, because as things stand, I think she's unintentionally doped. And I think she's, you know, looking at her support team of that time as the reason for it. And, you know, yes, she needed punishment for that, but she's back in the game. So I'm going to try and take that.
That's a combined event, Miami. There's every chance she'll see Patrick Mouratoglou in the bowels of the Hard Rock Stadium. I mean,
there's a reason to want her back then.
What do you say? Where are the Netflix cameras when you need them? That's our next news item, by the way.
It's too late.
I do remember Halep's quotes many years ago, around the time when Sharapova came back from her ban and started getting wild cards into events. Halep was very outspoken about that in terms of saying that it wasn't a good look for kids and young players for someone to have been banned for doping and then receiving wild cards. And of course, that then sort of led to that incredibly intense, dramatic first round meeting that they had at the US Open in 2017, when, like, I don't think Sharapova played better really after her comeback than when she felt like she had a point to prove against Simona Halep that night. And now here we are, and very much the shoe is on the other foot, and Halep is the one receiving the wild card.
Do we agree with that? Because the fact is, she has had a ban. She has had a 9-month doping ban. Do we agree? You take away all of the other hoo-ha, that is the bottom line fact. Do we agree with somebody, whoever it is, who has served a doping ban, receiving wild cards?
It's a good question, because I remember thinking, and I think I said at the time, I didn't think that Dan Evans should be given wild cards when he returned from his ban. And the difference being that he did knowingly take what he took. It wasn't regarded, I don't think, as performance enhancing, but it was in his system. And, you know, I suppose that's up for debate as to whether it's performance enhancing. It was a recreational one in his case. If we trust that it is there unintentionally, how much difference does that make? And that's, I suppose I still wouldn't really want people to be getting wild cards as such. But then I also think she's also been effectively banned for 18 months for a 9-month offence, if Cass is to be believed. So maybe this is the balancing act to that. I don't know.
So it's very good of the Miami Open to level that playing field. Matt, what do you think? Every time I ask you a question,
you just do a
very deep sigh. Sorry, Matt, but we are making a podcast here.
I mean, the thing is, look, wild cards are inherently kind of a bit unfair anyway, aren't they? Like, you can dig down into each layer of wild cards and the reason they're given, and they're unfair to someone. You know, tennis is a system which generally sort of prides itself on being a sort of meritocracy and ranking being so important, and yet we do have this wild card system in place. And given that we have the wild card system in place and why they exist, I think I probably end up being okay with it in this kind of instance, where, as David said, the latest finding that we have is that it was unintentional, and that she has served her ban. It's knotty. It's not I'm totally fine with it, but I can understand it for sure. As we're always saying, tennis is, it's an entertainment product as well, isn't it? And you know, if Halep's allowed to be competing again, I want to be seeing Simona Halep, former world number one and top player, playing if possible. So I do understand it, even if it leaves you a little bit uncomfortable. But then again, a lot of wild cards leave me sort of a little bit uncomfortable sometimes as well.
Mm. Okay, well, when CAS does release the full judgment, we will dedicate yet more of our time to reading it, and anything salient we will of course bring to you, and we'll be covering Halep's return to the court in great detail when that happens in Miami in just over a week's time. A couple of bits of other news for you before we move on to talk about what we've seen in Indian Wells so far. I hinted at it earlier, but we've had the news via Stu Fraser in the Times this week that Netflix is not renewing Breakpoint, the tennis documentary series, in the spirit of Drive to Survive. They will not be renewing for season 3. Not to do down Stu's story, because it has caused some waves. But I kind of thought we all knew this, that it wasn't going to be renewed for season 3. But that's me just being sort of overprivileged tennis insider type person. It just felt like the writing was on the wall with series 2 being reduced to 6 episodes, and it was very clear to us that there were no Netflix cameras around in Australia, and actually there were no Netflix cameras around at the year-end finals in Turin and Cancun as there were in 2022, and those events weren't covered in series 2 of Breakpoint. So it feels like they were winding down for quite some time, and their heart perhaps wasn't, you know, it's like when a series gets cancelled and you've still got to trudge through the remaining episodes. It felt like the writing was very much on the wall, possibly even from the very, very start of the whole thing. We'll cover our feelings about this in the Friends episode that we're going to be recording this month, in fact, isn't it? Or is it next month? What month are we in? March? April. Starts we're planning to record month, it, aren't right? we? Start of April. We're going to be recording a Friends show reviewing series 2 of Breakpoint, and a couple of other tennis documentaries that have come out as well. But big picture thoughts here, it's just a huge missed opportunity for tennis for all sorts of different reasons, some of which I understand, some of which I think are unforgivable. This is a huge missed opportunity for the sport, and that makes me sad. David, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree, and I think it didn't quite do what I thought it would do, and then it got worse because of what happened with the episode around Alexander Zverev. And I know we haven't reviewed it in quite the detail we will do, but I said at the time, the fact that they presented him in just a completely incomplete way, a misleading way, and without mentioning his charges that he faces for domestic abuse, he denies them, but they weren't even mentioned that they were, that it was an ongoing situation that he faces in his future and is part of his story at this point in time. That was just unforgivable to me. But even aside from that, I mean, I kind of want to throw it back to you, Catherine, because you drew my attention to Drive to Survive. I've never watched that. I've never seen an episode of it. But I was really taken by how excited about it you were when those first couple of seasons of that came out. You were talking to me about F1 all the time and I wasn't interested, but you wouldn't shut up about it. And our colleagues and friends on the No Laying Up Golf podcast, they were so totally into it, and they were always saying, imagine if there was a golf version of this. Well, there is. It's called Full Swing. I have yet to see season two of that, but I really enjoyed season one personally. And when they said they were going to do a tennis version, I was excited because I thought, okay, well, tennis could maybe do for lots and lots of other people what Drive to Survive has done for Catherine with F1. Now, maybe it has done for some people, and I just don't know who they are. But I've not come across many people who've said, oh, I'm really into tennis at the moment because of Breakpoint. And
well, I don't think Netflix have either, David.
And what are we up to? 6 series for Drive to Survive, isn't it? Mm. And I understand that it's the first one. And like in shortened format sport, they're always saying, oh, we're going to create the 2020 of tennis, you know, like 2020 cricket version, because that was so successful. Why doesn't it work in the same way? Or why hasn't it?
Well, I've got incredibly detailed thoughts on this, which we'll cover in the specific episode. I mean, there's a couple of things. Look, Drive to Survive launched at a time that just happened to coincide with one of the most exciting couple of seasons and exciting new rivalries the sport has ever seen. I think they did get some lucky breaks that tennis didn't get. But then Breakpoint launched in a season which began with the deportation of the world number one. You know, that's a pretty big story and a gift of a story to cover for a documentarian, and they barely covered it. Okay, it's not a sporting story, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it is a sporting story, but, you know, it's not strictly on the court. But Breakpoint had open goals, which it failed to score in. I do think there's something. It's revealed something pretty fundamental about tennis that makes it more difficult to cover in this format than Formula One. You know, I accept that there's 20 athletes in Formula One. There's 10 teams. There's a set number of races which all count for the same. Like, it's a pretty ideal format for documentarians to cover in terms of sport. It also has built-in stakes. You know, there's an undercurrent of life and death in Formula One. What's the difference between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings? It's stakes, it's jeopardy, it's peril. In Lord of the Rings, it's the entire future of humanity in Middle Earth. And in The Hobbit, it's just someone, like it's just a man on a little quest. And F1 just even when it's a dull season, there's the undercurrent of men risking their lives every time they get in the car. And I think they failed to identify how to bring stakes and jeopardy into tennis. And that was a big mistake. And some of that is structural and endemic to the sport. Some of it is a failure on the part of the producers to understand the sport, and some poor decision making. There's a lot going on there. And I know that, you know, players refuse to participate. Whose fault is that? I don't know. I've got thoughts on that, and it'll all be covered in the special show. But it's just such a shame.
Yeah, I think missed opportunity is the right way of looking at this. And because we're in an era, aren't we, where sports documentaries are very popular. So for one to be cancelled just after a couple of seasons suggests that this was done badly rather than there not being a market for it. As you said, tennis presents some very unique challenges compared to F1 with so many players. And I think they were always stuck between whether to cover players or storylines, and they never quite figured that out. Who was it for? Was it for hardcore fans? No, I don't think so. There was some interesting stuff for us in there, but probably not enough detail. at the same time, for total casual fans looking to get into the sport, I don't think there was enough juice or drama, as you've sort of described there. It does strike me that there might be a fundamental thing about tennis, in that tennis players are maybe at their most interesting on the court. You know, tennis is different to other sports in that we do see a lot of their personality on court. We feel like we know a lot of these players by how they behave and interact and play and adapt in high pressure situations. You know, we can see their faces in tennis. We see their facial expressions. Whereas F1, they needed to bring these people and their personalities alive, because when you're just watching the sport as a race, they're just helmets in a fast car. And you can't tell the difference between them, but the documentary, the show, sort of brought out their characters. But I don't know. Look, lots of tennis players are interesting off court, but lots of them aren't. And I think they didn't really show the sport to be that interesting as well. I had a lot of problems with the way they actually showed the sport. They showed unforced errors, and they showed bad editing of matches, and you know. There's a lot of great personality in tennis within the matches themselves that just wasn't covered at all. And I don't know.
Matt and I watched a couple of episodes of Series 2 together, and there was one point where they showed a double fault, and Matt exclaimed at the telly as if a Fulham player had just missed an open goal. It was extraordinary. He was furious.
They made the Sabalenka-Rybakina Australian Open final, like widely regarded as one of the highest quality Grand Slam finals in recent memory, look like utter trash. And I found that just really annoying and offensive. Yeah, as you said, look, there's lots of reasons. Very complicated reasons, I think, why it hasn't worked to the same degree as others. And Netflix are good at this generally. Like, they do know how to do sports documentaries. I think as you've both said, their coverage of Alexander Zverev, I thought, was incredibly misleading, and not even mentioning the very credible allegations against him is potentially sort of dangerous sort of marketing there. So I definitely think they made some errors. But like, if Netflix couldn't do it, then I don't know whether I would have trusted other people to necessarily make this kind of documentary about tennis and make it really interesting. Maybe tennis just is really hard. Yeah, I've sort of rambled on there, and we can save our thoughts for the Friends show. But definitely coming back to the beginning here, like, it's a shame, because I think there was a chance for this to be really good for tennis, and that wasn't the case.
Mm. Yeah, just a little teaser for the for that Friends show we're going to be recording. I, in the course of making my incredibly detailed notes about Netflix, about Breakpoint Series 2, I actually devised what my episode set list would have been for Season 2. Of Breakpoint, who I'd have covered, what stories I'd have covered. Haven't quite come up with titles for the episodes, but maybe if I have a slow week, I'll do that. Will that get people subscribing to become a friend? I don't know. Maybe that sounds fantastically boring. Catherine devises episode names for a documentary that's not going to be made. Great. Give us 50 quid. Thanks. There are other reasons to subscribe to become a friend of the podcast. I'm going to tell you about those in a minute. But first, one last bit of news from the week. The BBC reporting that a WTA event could come to the Queen's Club pre-Wimbledon. It could host a women's event for the first time since 1973. This from Russell Fuller, the BBC's tennis correspondent. If plans are approved, a WTA tournament will be held the week after the French Open in June on grass courts, which will be used by the men the following week. No final decision made yet, but we understand that the LTA and the All England Club are keen for this to happen. David, what do you think?
Yeah, as somebody who worked at that event for 25 years, it is something that I always used to think in the back of my mind, and especially when I would walk around the club and see photographs of great women champions of the past holding the trophy when they used to hold a women's event at the same time or nearby, and used to ask questions. Why isn't there a women's event? Should there be a women's event? And I mean, I think logistically, it just seemed an impossibility to do it in the same week. And from Russell's reporting in the BBC, that appears to still be the case. They're not going to be able to hold this as a combined event like they might in Rome or in Madrid. But this seems as though there's a lot of enthusiasm for within British tennis to do this, and the big question is it the right move? I mean, I remember a while back there was real investment in the Birmingham event, the WTA event that took place the week after the French Open. And look, I live in this area, I live in the Midlands, and I'm afraid to say it never really worked. The event here has never really taken hold, not like it has in Eastbourne, for instance, which is another event that is affected if this does happen. You know, there is talk that the Eastbourne event would be downgraded to a WTA 250 from its current 500, which who knows what sort of effect that might have on a player field, which has historically been really, really good and has been won so many times by Martina Navratilova, and is attended by so many big name players, and they get sellout crowds in Eastbourne. I mean, I kind of think that if they got a decent field, they would still get pretty sellout crowds at Eastbourne the week before, because there's such a tradition of the tournament there. Big question marks over whether the WTA event, if held the week after the French Open, which is being reported, i.e. the week before the men's event, whether that would be kind of the poor relation in terms of crowd turnout and player turnout, because, you know, those that go deep at Roland Garros aren't necessarily going to go straight to Queens. And we used to have that issue until 2015, when an extra week was put in between the French Open and Queens. You know, the field did get better when it became a 500 and that gap was brought in. Overall, though, I think this is probably a good move if they pull it off. I am a little bit worried about the concentration within London. That's not to say events aren't going to happen elsewhere, but the elevated nature of them will be in London again. And for people like me who live in Birmingham and people who live up north and so forth, don't you want to spread the word a bit more? That's one side of things. But I think the other one is, actually, if you stick this event on and it becomes a real success for women's tennis as well, and that becomes a two-week event. I mean, they have been absolutely packed to the rafters during the men's event the last couple of years. You get this great TV coverage. Hopefully they could get it on the BBC and also give it the same treatment that they've given the men's tournament. I think the overall good it would do would probably be superior to the things you would lose. That's my initial feeling.
Okay, well, we will watch that space, won't we? As and when there is news of that being confirmed or otherwise, we will bring it to you. We're going to talk about some actual tennis, forehands and backhands, tennis balls being hit in Indian Wells in just a few moments' time. But first, I'm going to give you a proper reason to subscribe to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast. And that is the latest edition of Tennis Relived that we recorded last week about the fashion designer, spy and author and tennis player, Ted Tindling. Yes, you heard that list of professions right, and if anything, that list doesn't even do the man justice. We loved learning about Ted Tindling so much. The response from friends that have listened to the show already has been so warm and overwhelming, and we're so thrilled that you've enjoyed learning about Ted just as much as we enjoyed learning about Ted. And if you're thinking of becoming a friend, Matt has put together a wonderful little teaser trailer for the episode just to whet your appetite. It is the second edition of Tennis Relived that we've recorded this year. We've also done two live YouTube shows exclusively for friends. We're going to be doing one per month of those, so another one coming at you later this month. We do Grand Slam review shows. We've got Hannah's column. We are launching our friends platform, the community platform, which has a very special name that we'll be sharing with you soon. We'll be launching that later this month. So there's exciting stuff going on for friends of the Tennis Podcast. And the link to become a friend, if you're interested, is in the show notes. Here is Matt's wonderful trailer about Tennis Relived, Ted Tinling.
I took the train to his studio in Philadelphia, a really cool place, and Ted measured me. When Ted measured you, I mean, he truly took the measure of you, all right? He measured every bit of you. I'd never had something like that done to me, but he measured, you know, your waist and your back and your shoulders and your brain pan and your quickness and your wit. I mean, that this guy didn't miss anything. But then I started asking him questions because it was Ted Tinling, for God's sakes. And he knew everything about everybody. I mean, Ted saw stuff, and he knew stuff, and he sensed stuff. I think he knew I was gay before I did.
Madam Superstar, he used to call me. I go, don't call me that. I get so embarrassed. I go, Ted, don't say that. He says, well, you are Madam Superstar. And he'd get on me, and we'd sit and talk about the future of tennis all the time and what we need to do. And he was really smart. He was so much fun for me. Oh, my God. Don't eat with him, though. He spits his food across the room. That was always, we always had to get ready for the dart coming, like, you know. Oh. Anyway, it was so cute.
He lived in Philadelphia the latter part of his life and decided he was going to give his body to science at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School when he passed away. And he wrote it into his will. And he even, Ted wore a very large diamond earring. And he included the fact that if he died overseas, he wanted the diamond earring removed from his ear and used to transport him from wherever he was back to Philadelphia. And one morning he told me that he had a problem with this because the university had called him and said, we have a problem here because there's nothing in the will about how to transport you from the Philadelphia airport to the University of Pennsylvania. And so he said he rewrote that section of his will to include cab fare to get him to Penn. He said, I didn't want to ride the bloody bus.
Wearing a Ted Tinling dress, you know, made me feel like a true professional, like an insider. I mean, if you were part of his world, I mean, you felt like you were in, you know? Oh, my God, you guys. The Tennis Podcast people would have absolutely adored Ted Tinling.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or on your smart TV in HD.
Sounds great. There's genuinely nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere.
And can I just sit and watch court shows in Longland all day?
You sure can, David. Wherever the stories are, the rivalries emerge and the generations clash, you can watch it all with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Be there when it happens by subscribing to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TennisPod20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Welcome back to part two of the show, the part where we're going to talk about tennis, folks. Or actually, we're going to talk about tennis in just a moment, because first of all, should we cover the withdrawals that we had from Indian Wells? A couple of incredibly notable withdrawals. First of all, ahead of the tournament, Rafael Nadal withdrew. It's supposed to be his comeback event after that injury that he sustained at his other comeback event in Australia. He said, "I have been working hard and practicing, and you all know I took a test this weekend, but I don't find myself ready to play at the highest level at such an important event. It's not an easy decision. It's a tough one, as a matter of fact, but I can't lie to myself and lie to the thousands of fans." It's on the basis of that information, it's very difficult for us to know or to speculate about how bad this is for Nadal and his hopes on the clay. Matt is an eternal optimist, re Nadal. Matt saw this news and went, "Well, he just wants to get right for the clay, so good luck to him." I saw this news and thought, I could just see a situation where it's like when you're waiting for a Southwest train and it starts off being 1 minute delayed, and then it's 3 minutes delayed, and then it's 5 minutes delayed, and suddenly you're on a rail replacement bus. So let's get some optimism from Matt.
You know, this might be an incredibly privileged thing to say, but I've never gone on a rail replacement bus. I've just abandoned
the journey.
Nor should you.
Yeah, it's better. Wherever you're, no matter how good where you're going is going to be, it's never worth a rail replacement bus.
Mm. I must say, when I was watching the Las Vegas exhibition, which I think is what Nadal is referring to there in his statement in terms of that test that he took, you know, I know it's an exhibition, but in the second half of that, I have never seen Nadal move worse on a tennis court. Like, I thought he looked so heavy and sore, almost moving to his right, especially not at all sharp like he was when he came out at the start of the season in Brisbane, and actually looked really good. And there were some quotes in the Spanish press where Nadal said his preparation between Australia and Indian Wells was way worse than it had been at the back end of last season. I have to feel like if he wasn't playing that exhibition, he might not even have gone on this trip in the first place. He might have just withdrawn from Indian Wells prior to even getting on a plane. So I was feeling pretty down about it, honestly. But then he did put a video up on Instagram of him bashing out the clay from his shoes. And suddenly I was getting all excited about the clay court season again.
He was sitting down in that
video. I know. There was no evidence of him playing tennis whatsoever. it's become pretty clear that this comeback now is all about the clay court season, I think. And it's first and foremost, it's about being fit and being able to string matches together. And until we see him do that, I think in successive tournaments, it's just very, very hard to sort of know where Nadal stands at the moment. But yeah, it's not good, but I'm pleased that he didn't risk it and play Indian Wells, because the clay is the time of the year where he's most likely to be fit. And most likely to have his best results as well.
Okay, well, fingers and toes crossed. We get to see Nadal looking like Rafael Nadal on clay, whatever that might mean. We also had the withdrawal of the women's defending champion, Elena Rybakina. TBC on whether this was because she caught sight of her mural that she gets as a defending champion. I do love that tradition in Indian Wells that they do a mural of all the champions, but the quality, I would say, is variable. In terms of likeness, they're all nice pieces of art in themselves, but the likeness can definitely vary. And for some reason, Elena Rybakina is brunette in her mural, and Carlos Alcaraz has acquired some facial hair that he's never had. but yeah, it's another event with Rybakina withdrawing due to illness. And this is a worrying trend for Rybakina, isn't it? Ever since she had what we now know was COVID during the French Open last year that caused her to withdraw mid-tournament. Ever since then, she has kept, whether it's relapsing or just getting really unlucky with new illnesses, I don't know what's going on, but it hasn't been quite right from a health perspective for nearly a year now. And this, if it's starting to feel like a worrying trend rather than a series of unfortunate events, David.
Yeah. It's all you want is players to be able to be fit and play and let the tennis work out who's the best. And we've got this burgeoning opportunity at the top of the women's game right now, of which she should be such an integral part, being derailed by her health. And it's really frustrating because the three of them that are right there, and Coco Gauff on the rails as well, they're pretty much nailed on great matches and a good rivalry, whichever way around you look at it. But yeah, Rybakina being out was a real downer, and I let's hope it's just a little flare up or some sort of minor thing. But yeah, when it's repeatedly happening, and I don't know what it's down to, but as somebody who had COVID and developed long COVID and still gets flare ups of it if I behave in a certain way, if I overdo it, I just hope it's not that, really, or a variance of that, because I don't quite know how you manage that if you're a professional athlete who needs to be going flat out every couple of days.
Yeah, we absolutely wish her well. There has been some good stuff happening in Indian Wells. This is where we talk about the positive stuff, folks. Alcaraz looks like Alcaraz again, doesn't he? The last couple of matches that we've seen from Carlos Alcaraz, it's been full Alcarazmataz, and it's been a joy to watch. I felt confident in him again. I haven't felt edgy the way I have done quite a bit more recently watching Carlos. You've had the same feeling, haven't you, Matt?
I have. He obviously lost his first set in Indian Wells this year to Arnaldi. That was a great set. But then Alcaraz just took his game to a whole new level in the next two sets and was brilliant. And he carried that forward and was excellent yesterday against Felix Auger-Aliassime, a player who he's lost to in the past. But I do already think of Alcaraz as someone who has spots on the calendar where he really thrives and plays well. And I think of Indian Wells as one of those locations. I think Madrid is another one. He seems very comfortable at Indian Wells. The last couple of years, he's been excellent there. And he seems to have found that form again. There's some very interesting matches coming up for him, potentially, as this tournament develops. He's got Fabian Marijan next, of course, who is known pretty much only for beating Carlos Alcaraz in Rome last year. And then he's potentially got Alex de Minaur or Alexander Zverev.
De Minaur, who absolutely killed Alexander Bublik yesterday.
Yes.
Just crushed him.
Yes, especially Bublik's second serve. Like, I think he won like almost like 90% of the points on Bublik's second serve. It was ridiculous. But Zverev, of course, good head-to-head against Alcaraz, and de Minaur, one of the most informed players on the tour right now. So, and then if he gets through that, there's potentially Jannik Sinner in the semi-finals, who is looking just awesome as well. It was like just the fact that Sinner followed Alcaraz onto the court yesterday, and they both produced these incredible performances. That didn't feel like a coincidence. They just have total trust in Jannik Sinner at the moment that he's going to do that. So I think we learn a lot more about Alcaraz over this next week, having to go through players that he's lost against in the past. But so far, the signs are much better. And crucially, he seems fit and recovered from that ankle roll in Rio.
Yeah, the ankle seems absolutely fine, doesn't it? Which is great to be able to say. I always find it really fun when a player comes into Indian Wells unbeaten. The whole, like, who's going to be the one to beat them? Because Jannik Sinner, brilliant as he is, he's not going to go the remainder of his career unbeaten. Someone, sometime, is going to beat him. We just don't know who it's going to be and when and where. And that's really fun.
Really fun. And I think it adds just an extra edge to kind of all of his matches when you're watching. Because I was watching his first match against Kokkinakis and I was like, oh, it's 3-3 in the first set. Kokkinakis is doing pretty well here. And then suddenly Sinner just wins like the last 9 games of the match. And it's like, oh, okay. I don't know why I thought that this could be the one where Sinner's going to lose. And then yesterday he's up against the big, strong Jan-Lennard Struff, who's always pretty dangerous. And he just swatted him aside as well. He's looking so good. He's got Ben Shelton next, who is one of only 2 players to have beaten post-puke Sinner. he was in fact the first player to beat post-puke Sinner. He beat him in Shanghai shortly after Beijing.
Most recently post-puke, yeah.
Yeah, when the puke was still at its strongest. Sorry, I should stop talking about puke. I mean, Shelton right now, I think we might have to give him the moniker of best show in tennis. Like, all of his matches right now are thrilling. He's played five consecutive deciding sets, a couple of deciding set tiebreaks in there as well. Yesterday he was being heckled in the crowd by all the Cerundolo fans up in the gods of the stadium, and they were...
It's not something you say very often, is it, all the Cerundolo fans? Certainly outside of Argentina, anyway.
And they were talking during his second serve, and he won the match on that, and then turned round and sort of had a bit of a go back. I loved it. I just don't know if he's got the level right now to live with Sinner consistently. Like, I think he'll bring it in flashes, Shelton, but Sinner's bringing it every game right now. He's so locked in. So yeah, look, I think that's a really fascinating sort of narrative. Who can be the one to beat Sinner? Because at the moment, it feels like he is the best player in the world right now, and it feels like that.
David, you've got him winning the tournament, so you think it's going to be another couple of weeks before anyone beats Jannik Sinner, minimum?
Yeah, well, I have, because I mean, what evidence is there to the contrary that he's not the best player right now? I then do try to remind myself, hold on, we haven't even mentioned the words Novak Djokovic yet, who's in the draw, and who will be monitoring, not necessarily our conversation, but the murmurs of Sinner domination. And we know what happens when Novak Djokovic feels maybe he's got a point to prove. And I watched the last 4 sets that Carlos Alcaraz played as well, and he just reminded me why he's so exciting. I mean, and how much I want to see him play Jannik Sinner. And it does, I agree with you, having Sinner on an unbeaten run with those guys in the draw, and obviously with Shelton next, and I do think Shelton's lack of form is the reason he's playing so many thrillers right now, so I don't think Sinner will be overly tested in that personally. But it does add a premium to every match Sinner plays.
The Djokovic element that David mentioned there is so interesting, isn't it? Because this is obviously his first time at Indian Wells for 5 years, and a lot of that was sort of self-imposed in terms of not being vaccinated and not being allowed into the US. But I have almost sort of written off this time of season for Novak Djokovic in the past few years. This is, you know, the bit in between the majors. It's the bit that seems to matter the least to him right now, this little bit in the calendar and the start of the clay court season. And then we get into, you know, the meat of the season, the bit that he really cares about. But exactly as David said, he cares so much about making sure, I think, that Jannik Sinner doesn't have the upper hand, doesn't have the number on him. And we saw what he did to Carlos Alcaraz in Cincinnati, straight off losing to him at Wimbledon. He is going to want to beat Jannik Sinner the next time he plays him after what Sinner did to him at the Australian Open. And Djokovic looked a little bit rusty in that first round at match that he played, as you would expect. But given that he's in the other bit of the draw, if he can just make his way through, and if he does end up playing Sinner in the final, for example, I think he would be so fired up to win that. And that adds a different dimension to this time of the season that we've just not really had for Novak Djokovic for a while.
Brilliant, as we've said, Carlos Alcaraz has been for the last four sets he's played. Still the highlights reel prize for week one, certainly on the men's side, has to go to Gael Monfils, doesn't it? Partying like it's 2012. Gael Monfils taking a 6-love set off Hubert Hurkacz. What a joy. I don't know what it means, but what a joy that was. You've probably seen various points from it circulating on social media, because it was just, I mean, it was a highlights reel. It was ridiculous. And it was wonderful to see. So well done, Gael Monfils. In terms of the women's event, what have we seen? We've seen Jessica Pegula beaten by Anna Blinkova of Rybakina, Australian Open tiebreak fame, of course. Pegula, I mean, I guess it's going to take a bit of time, isn't it? She's in an unsettled period in her career. She did give some interesting quotes, didn't she, on the eve of Indian Wells about the reason behind her split from David Witt, and it just feeling like, not like a now or never moment in her career, but kind of like she's approaching 30, and if she's going to take a risk, it feels like it has to be now. And I did find that interesting, you know, acknowledging that it is a risk, but it's a calculated one, and one she feels like she needs to take so she doesn't look back with regrets. And I certainly have question marks over whether it'll end up being a fruitful decision, but I certainly respect that that mindset of just feeling like you have to take the risk.
Mm. Do you know, the fact that she has yet to achieve her goals, her additional, her stretch goals, you might call them, of going really deep in Grand Slam tournaments, makes that the right decision to me, whether or not it yields better results. I just feel you've got to try something different at this stage, and I understand why she did it. I'm quite pleased she's sort of said that and come clean that that's why she did it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a tough post Australian Open period, hasn't it, for Zheng Qinwen? She was beaten by Yuan Yui, her countrywoman, and the misery of Yvonne Strabeur continues. She was beaten by Katie Vollinets in the opening round, who did play really well and created some highlights reel stuff of her own, did Vollinets. But God, it's a miserable old time for Strabeur, isn't it? It's tough for her just now. We've had mothers on tour having a great week. Caroline Wozniacki, she's into the fourth round, as is Naomi Osaka, Angelique Kerber, and Elina Svitolina. Feels like Osaka and Kerber, this is the tournament they've been waiting for, you know, to really get their teeth into and get some momentum behind their respective comebacks. And I'm absolutely here for it. For both of them, I'm just so pumped to look through an order of play and see their names in the draws, because I want to watch their matches, you know.
Yeah, and Osaka, I think, got one of her best wins so far against Samsonova. I watched quite a bit of that, and there was a nice surge when she was break points down in that first set. Just came up with some massive serves at the right time. And I just felt like generally she kept up her energy and intensity very well throughout that match. She's got a very completely different test today against Elise Mertens, who will really test that ability to keep it going consistently throughout the whole match, in a way that, you know, maybe Samsonova is a nicer matchup for Osaka in terms of just sort of being a bit more of a hitting contest. Kerber Wozniacki in the last 16. Talk about partying like it's 2012. I remember they had one of the most iconic rallies in Indian Wells or maybe tennis history when they played in here about 10 years ago in the semifinals. Just a series of moon balls, one after the other. And Wozniacki is literally at the net at one point in the rally, but doesn't hit a volley. He just retreats to the baseline to start moonballing again, and it's just hilarious. And I just hope that they recreate it in this match. Just the sort of recognizing that this was a great moment. Let's do it again. Playing one another. Kerber Wozniacki, last 16. Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's awesome. And you know, they've both won three matches this tournament. Wozniacki, the first time she's done that since the US Open. Kerber had a couple of great wins over Ostapenko and Kudermetova. So, yeah, like one of them's going to be in the quarterfinals, which is a great story.
Coco Gauff needed a deciding set tiebreak to beat Clara Burrell. That was, it was the absolute definitive Coco Gauff performance, wasn't it? It was winning ugly and falling back on just the most finely tuned competitive instincts in the sport at the moment. I love watching her in that mode. It was great fun. I think was she 4-love down in that deciding set?
Yeah,
I think she was.
And 5-2. I mean, she was right up against it. But yeah, putting her away is another matter. And and she just seems to get better in those situations. You can see that she's almost relishing it. I don't know whether that is the truth, but it looks like, oh, right, now this is what I've been waiting for. I'm 5-2 down. Watch out. And she comes out firing.
Sabalenka as well made an incredible comeback and won in a deciding set tiebreak against Peyton Stearns.
That match was unbelievably good. One of the best I've seen this year for sure. Sabalenka was three match points down in a row on Stearns' serve, saved four in that game altogether. One with a very un-Sabalenka like shot, a slice down the line onto the line to save one of the match points. And we kind of didn't really talk about her loss to Donna Vekic in Dubai a few weeks ago. Sabalenka in her first match since winning the Australian Open, but wasn't great. Like, it was a real loss of form during that match, during the latter half of it. Her game just went completely, as good as Vekic was. And if she'd then lost to the first round of Indian Wells as well, you'd have thought, sort of, what's going on, really, straight after that incredible tennis that we saw in Melbourne. So I think that's a pretty big win for Sabalenka to try and get back on track, obviously post the most amazing start to the season. Just high drama, high quality in this match. And she now plays Emma Raducanu, does Sabalenka. So the sort of great matches just keep coming. Raducanu, who I don't think's ever beaten a top 10 player. So it would be sort of interesting to see sort of where Raducanu's level is at compared to one of the very best players in the world. I think that would be a good sort of test for Raducanu, and I can't wait to watch it.
So I just hope she can see that as a totally free hit, Raducanu, and swing with freedom. You know, that's all that I want from her in that match. Iga Świątek still in the draw, a draw that looked tricky for her, but that she's navigated very elegantly so far. No troubles against Danielle Collins this time. Fairly straightforward for her in her opening match, and she looked like she might have been in trouble against Linda Noskova, of course, who she lost to in the Australian Open. She was a breakdown in the opening set, and then Noskova had points to go a double breakup, failed to take them, but she's still a single breakup. She's still on top in this opening set. And to say she fell apart would be an understatement, quite frankly. I mean, she just vacated the court at that point, pretty much. It was a quite extraordinary collapse, actually, a slightly alarming one. Once Świątek had her teeth into the match, she hit full flow and she was great.
It's interesting how this is such a redo of the Australian Open for Świątek. Mm. You know, Collins and Noskova, who she played back-to-back in Melbourne, has played back-to-back here. And as you said, just been much more straightforward matches. And even to the point where one of the things that made that loss to Noskova so brutal, I think, for Świątek was that Rybakina was out. Ostapenko lost early as well, didn't she? And those were sort of two of her toughest head-to-heads. And they're both gone in this tournament as well, Rybakina and Ostapenko. It does feel like she's just sort of having the Australian Open experience again, but just sort of doing it slightly differently. And we know that she loves the conditions in Indian Wells generally. So, it's rare, I think, that sort of tennis gives you the same set of circumstances so soon again. But Świątek seems to be in that
unless
situation.
Unless you're Andy Murray and Alex de Minaur. niche tennis joke for you there. And I think that's pretty much it in terms of the Indian Wells wrap of what we've had so far. We will, though, because it is a combined 1,000 event, we will be back with another podcast on Thursday. We're going to record that Thursday evening. So we'll have that up for you later on in the evening. And it'll look back on what we'll see over the next few days. And, of course, look ahead to the quarters, semis and finals in Indian Wells. So make sure you join us for that. We have a mascot for this episode. And I'm delighted to say it is Rosie, owned by Adam. Rosie is a 2-year-old golden retriever and is such a sweet, gentle dog. She loves being with her humans, chewing palm fronds and swimming at the beach and being chased. So I'm getting the impression Rosie is not a south of England or an England based dog, because I don't think palm fronds and beach swimming would be such a feature of her life if she were. She's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I've never known a retriever that isn't, but she's beautiful and she's got a great name. So thank you, Adam, for bringing Rosie into our lives. There'll be a picture of her in this week's newsletter, which will be going out when, Matt? And is it going to be excellent?
Well, of course it's going to be excellent, and it will go out... Who can say? Tuesday or Wednesday, it tends to be.
The point is, there's still time to subscribe. I mean, you can subscribe anytime and it's free. So why wouldn't you do that?
I've done my stat. I've done my stat already.
You've done your stat. Ooh, is that excellent?
It's good. The bar's been high recently. I've done some good stats recently.
Yeah, I mean, the bar's been very high.
Unfailingly excellent. And I'm always dumbfounded how you come up with the ideas for them. So, yes, subscribe, if nothing else, for Matt's stats.
David's much better at doing the sell on the newsletter than I am.
I know, but I enjoyed seeing you squirm. It's great. We have our mascots. I have the dearly departed Darwin. And both I and David, who is sponsored by Francis, we both picked Rybakina mere minutes before her withdrawal this week. So that was great. Thanks for that.
Rumours that it might be a reason for her withdrawal are not
the curse.
Not
the curse of Darwin continues. Matt has Haider and Soma. Billie Jean, curled up asleep beside me, is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Chris, Greg, Jamie and Jeff. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We start with Eleanor, or maybe it should be Elena, because Eleanor has written same as Rybakina.
Oh, very helpful, Elena. Thank you.
Done our work for us. Thank you, Elena.
What else do we know about Elena?
We know that she's from Philadelphia and that she discovered the pod in 2022, right after Roland Garros.
Oh, so that would have been, well, Nadal winning, obviously.
And yeah. Iga Świątek winning. And my return classic. To Roland Garros and discovery of Long Len.
David's discovery.
A court. So
that was a good time, wasn't it?
Maybe
David
I influenced
discovering
things.
Roland Garros. Elena Dementieva as well.
Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you, Elena. And hello.
We've also got Mr. Kiwi Kiwi Little Dog in Portland, Oregon. And whoever has filled in the form for Mr. Kiwi Kiwi Little Dog says, I hope David is less appalled this time that I gave up my shout out to my dog.
Given that you've made me laugh, I'm going to let that go for sure.
Do we know anything else about Mister?
I've given you all the information that I have.
Definitely.
Okay.
What a
mysterious person.
The only Kiwi I can give you tennis-wise, rather than just going with somebody
from
New Zealand.
I'm keen to hear this.
I can tell you that Nicholas Kiefer used to be nicknamed Kiwi.
Is this one of your nicknames?
No, it wasn't actually. Everybody used to call him that, so I joined in, amongst other names that I also gave him.
You've done well there, David, to fashion a tennis likeness out of Mr. Kiwi Kiwi Little Dog. That is stunning work. Thank you, Mr. Kiwi Kiwi. Much appreciated.
And finally, we've got Katie Bevan from Southend-on-Sea.
Hello,
hi, Katie.
Katie completed her fan grand slam in January at the Australian Open.
Wow. Katie, that is awesome.
She produces a breakfast radio show, and her 4:30 alarm can be a little lonely, she says, so the pod is the perfect companion.
I don't know how people do breakfast shows. I honestly don't.
David could.
I think I could pull it off, yeah.
David was born for breakfast shows.
Yeah, David would happily make the weekly podcast a breakfast show.
The podcast would be a breakfast
could.
Show if, in David's ideal
David's
idea
just
world.
Sitting there waiting for me to wake up.
I'd be so bang on it if it was a breakfast show. Be a two-man job, but...
Like Katie Volinets, who did lose to Caroline Wozniacki last night, but beat Ons Jabeur in round one. So thank you, Katie. And one last shout out from me to Pam Shriver, who received the Georgina Clark Mother Award this week, and very deservedly so. So well done, Pam.
Go on, Pam.
Go on, Pam.
That's it for this week, but you don't have to wait long for the next podcast. We'll be back on Thursdays with more Indian Wells chat. I know it's been a bumper one this time, but tennis keeps throwing news at us, and when it's thrown, we will cover it. So thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you on Thursday.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.